Hi, and welcome to Your Health, the weekly podcast from NPR's Science Desk. I'm April Fulton.
And I'm Scott Hensley. You may know me as the irrepressible health blogger, but today I am filling in for Rebecca Davis as co-host of the podcast. She's on vacation.
Nice. Well, that's right, Scott. I roped you in again. And this week we've got the politics of food safety.
And some cool new stuff in heart science.
Right. But first, let's start with the blog. Lots of good stuff here. Let's start with pesticides. You had this really interesting post about the best and the worst vegetables with pesticides. Can you tell us a little more?
Sure. The Department of Agriculture has to check this stuff every year, and they came out with a report in late May, which I didn't see at the time, but the Environmental Working Group and Advocacy Group used data from that report, plus some others, to come up with a best list and a worst list of fruits and vegetables that you should think about when it comes to pesticides.
Okay, so what do you mean by best? Like, they have the least amount of pesticides?
Unless you're a big pesticide consumption fan.
What are the worst? What are the worst offenders?
All right, so the worst was apples.
Okay.
And the best were onions. And the Environmental Working Group came up with a dirty dozen of the things you might want to consider buying organic to avoid pesticides for those foods that are the worst. And then for the ones that don't have much, don't worry about it. And on the list of things not to worry about were pineapples was one that didn't have very many very much pesticide residue.
Mm-hmm.
And then in an interesting twist, when we dug into the USDA report, there was a pilot test of organic lettuce, and it turned out 20% of the organic lettuce had pesticide residue.
Wait, there's pesticides allowed on organic produce?
Believe it or not, yes. There is a short list of pesticides, and the one that was found most often in the lettuce is a result of bacteria. It's made by bacteria, and we're looking into it. So stay tuned. We're going to have more on the blog about this soon.
Okay, so is there like such a problem here that we should consider not eating fruits and vegetables? I mean, how big a risk are these pesticides?
Keep eating your fruits and vegetables. Even the EWG, which is against pesticide residues, said there's more benefit to be had from making sure you get enough fruit and vegetables, as you wrote about recently on the food plate versus the food pyramid.
Right. So speaking of things we should be eating or shouldn't be eating, I wrote a post this week about the Los Angeles school district, the big school district there, banning chocolate milk from school lunches.
What led them to make that move, April?
Well, they, like many school districts, have been looking at trying to make school lunch healthier. And one of the main controversial issues is flavored milk. Kids drink milk that's flavored because it tastes better than regular milk, but it's got a lot of sugar in it.
Is it worth the trade-off? Can't you get some kids who wouldn't drink the milk otherwise to swallow it if it's got a little bit of flavor added?
That's what the dairy industry says. They have a lot of studies that show consumption of milk actually goes down if there's not an option of flavored milk. So, you know, we'll see what the other school districts around the country do, but there's a huge push right now to try to get more fruits and vegetables, less processed foods, and healthier foods in school lunches. So I think there's a big question, though, of whether kids will actually eat it.
Did the LA district take action on any other foods on the menu?
Yep. They also got rid of chicken nuggets, and they banned soda a couple years ago. They're pretty much out in front on this right now. So look out, New York. They're probably close behind. So speaking of eating, we also have a post on our lagging lifespans.
There's a new analysis that came out this week from a group at the University of Washington and some of their colleagues in London, crunching the data on how the U.S. is actually doing county by county when it comes to lifespans.
Mm-hmm.
And I should say, the good news is that overall, Americans are living longer than ever, so we can be happy about that. But the spread, the variation in the life expectancy for people who were born just in the last few years varies tremendously. And in some counties, in Mississippi, for instance, the lifespans for girls born recently in some Mississippi counties is on par with some countries in the developing world. On the other hand, there are some counties in the U.S. where we can hold our heads high and say, okay, these people are going to live a long time. And for women, the top county in the U.S. is Collier County in Florida. And for men, it was right around the corner from NPR HQ in Fairfax County, Virginia.
So how long are we living on average, Americans?
For women, it's around 81 years. Mm-hmm. And for men, it's about 76.
Mm-hmm. So why do they think some people are not living as long?
Obesity is a big problem mm-hmm. in the U.S., and that's a real big factor. In the U.S., even though we're living longer than we ever had, the report sounds a cautionary note. We're falling behind the gains in other countries that are doing a better job. So if you compare how we're doing to countries that are sort of leading the way, the gap between the U.S. and those countries is widening. And that's kind of that's a big part of what they were trying to point out with this analysis.
What countries are leading the way, are doing a pretty good job of lifespan length?
Japan would be one. And some of the Northern European countries mm-hmm, also.
Mm-hmm. A lot of fish.
Yeah.
Could be. Okay. Well, thanks a lot. If you want to check out our blog for everything you missed, go to npr.org/shots. But we're going to keep Scott around because he's going to help me co-host this. So let's move on to our radio pieces. In this country, the Food and Drug Administration is ordering makers of sunscreens to stop calling their products waterproof. It's also demanding they clear up the confusion about what sun protection factor, or SPF, really means. The rule doesn't go into effect for another year, and as Nancy Shute reports, that could lead to some confusion at the beach and at the pool in the short term.
It's still early in the swim season, but the can of sunscreen on the lifeguard chair at Mohican Pool in Bethesda, Maryland is almost empty. The label promises an SPF of 30, but lifeguard Justin Masters isn't quite sure what that number means.
Sun protection something? Sunproofness?
What does it protect you from?
The harmful UVA or UVB rays or one of the other, something like that.
Masters is almost right. The SPF, or sun protection factor, measures a sunscreen's ability to prevent sunburn. That's caused by ultraviolet B light. But scientists now know that ultraviolet A is a major cause of aging and also contributes to skin cancer. And the SPF on the label doesn't tell you anything at all about UVA protection. Michael Hansen is a senior scientist at Consumers Union. It's one of the groups that has been pushing the FDA for years to require better labels.
Consumers might have a misinterpretation, not realizing that they're not being fully protected.
The new FDA rule should help. It will require any sunscreen that calls itself broad spectrum to do a good job against both UVB and UVA. That sounds good to Mohican Pool manager Ellen Hurl. She's 21 years old.
I already have some wrinkles on my forehead from doing 6 summers of this.
She'd also like a sunscreen that didn't wash off in the pool.
I definitely need something that's waterproof because we're going in the water a lot.
But the FDA now says there's no such thing as a waterproof sunscreen. They all wash off in water or with sweat. Starting next summer, the best a label will be able to claim is that a sunscreen is water resistant. That leaves the question of how to avoid cancer-causing rays while manufacturers retool sunscreens and labels. David LaFell is a professor of dermatology at Yale University. He says people still do have good options for this summer.
Number one, make sure that your sunscreen has a sun protection factor, or SPF, of 30.
Number two,
make sure that it says broad spectrum.
Protecting against both UVA and UVB. For UVA, LaFell says to look for products that contain zinc oxide or avobenzone. Recommendation number three.
Whether the label says sweatproof or waterproof, you should reapply every couple of hours while you're active outdoors anyways, because sunscreen does wear off.
And LaFell says it is possible to be well protected without using any sunscreen at all.
A T-shirt, a white T-shirt, gives you a sun protection factor of 6, which frankly is not very helpful at all. But there are so many products out there, sun protective clothing products, that are rated for their sun protection and don't look like prison uniforms anymore. They actually look like real clothing.
Real clothing that perhaps even a lifeguard would wear. And that's a good thing because skin cancer rates in young people are on the rise.
We're seeing it in women in their 20s, which used to be unheard of.
The bottom line? There are still very good reasons to use sunscreens, even if they are less than perfect. Nancy Shute, NPR News.
Speaking of less than perfect, there's our food safety system. President Obama's administration is considering whether to screen for more strains of E. coli in hamburger meat than just the 0157H7 we hear so much about. The move comes as Europe faces a huge outbreak of food poisoning and at a time when the political climate in the U.S. is hostile to regulation. Scott Horsley reports.
President Obama had been in office less than 2 months when he announced a fresh commitment to food safety. He approached the issue not only as president, but as a parent, he said. No one should have to worry about getting sick from the peanut butter on a child's sandwich.
There are certain things that we can't do on our own. There are certain things only government can do. And one of those things is ensuring that the foods we eat and the medicines we take are safe.
2 years later, that commitment is being tested. Food safety expert David Thino was hired by Jack in the Box back in the early 1990s after hamburgers tainted with E. coli from the chain killed 4 people. Thino's watched with alarm this spring as a different strain of E. coli killed dozens of people in Europe and sickened thousands more.
This thing in Europe right now has an eerily familiar feeling. Here we got an organism that is kind of new on the radar screen. It's creating huge problems, and people are scrambling again.
The Jack in the Box outbreak in 1993 was a warning siren about what became the most notorious form of E. coli. The USDA began random screening for the bug that year and ruled, over the objections of the beef industry, that hamburger containing the bacteria could not be sold. Jack in the Box adopted its own screening process, which Thino says initially cost about 2 cents a pound.
If you multiply it across a bazillion pounds, it's a lot of money. But it's a pretty low-cost insurance policy.
Over the years, the beef industry and others have made progress in controlling that particular strain of E. coli. Since 1997, the number of infections has been cut in half. But food poisoning from other strains of E. coli, like the one now plaguing Europe, are on the rise. Thino says some food vendors have begun testing for those other dangerous bugs, but not everyone.
Some people would say, if it's not a problem today, then it's not a problem. And that's where government regulations come in.
Earlier this year, the USDA proposed a new regulation that reportedly would treat 6 other dangerous strains of E. coli the same way it treats the bug behind the Jack in the Box outbreak. That prospect alarms the beef industry. Scientific Director Betsy Barine of the American Meat Institute Foundation says testing for 7 different strains of bacteria would take a lot longer than testing for one.
And that means much more product would have to be stored. And the longer you store it, the shorter the shelf life becomes, and then you may actually lose hundreds of thousands of pounds of product that, you know, ultimately is a great source of protein.
The USDA proposal has been under review by the White House Office of Management and Budget since January. Meanwhile, congressional Republicans have been criticizing the administration for what they call over-regulation. Here's Tennessee Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn grilling a White House official earlier this month.
The American people are hopeful for jobs. And what you're doing with sending out all these regulations is wrong. You've got to find a way to get some of this regulation off the books.
The administration itself has promised to get rid of some regulations and make others more simple, flexible, and cost-effective. When it comes to the E. coli proposal, an administration spokesman says there are a lot of complicated technical issues at play and a lot of stakeholders to consider. But as the White House review drags into its 5th month, consumer advocates like Carol Tucker Foreman are growing frustrated. Tucker Foreman used to oversee food safety as an assistant secretary of agriculture.
The president said there are some things that government has to do, and this is one of those things. But his folks are sitting on it.
When government regulation is routinely denounced in Washington as a job killer, fighting bacteria that kills people, it's easier said than done. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Now on to the search for the perfect artificial heart. For decades, surgeons have tried and failed to find a machine that doesn't wear out, break down, or cause clots or infections. Surgeons in Texas say they've developed a machine that could avoid all those problems. And it's a heart without a heartbeat. Carrie Feibel at member station KUHF in Houston explains.
For years, doctors believed that any artificial heart would have to mimic the real heart. It would have to pump rhythmically, squeezing and relaxing. After all, having a heartbeat, a pulse, is what it means to be alive. But Dr. Billy Cohn at the Texas Heart Institute says we should just forget all that. To prove that it can work, he takes me inside the animal research laboratory to meet Abigail.
Good girl. She jumps up because she wants water.
Abigail is an 8-month-old calf with a soft brown coat. Cohn and his partner, Dr. Bud Frazier, removed her heart and replaced it with 2 centrifugal pumps.
If you listened to her chest with a stethoscope, you wouldn't hear a heartbeat. If you examined her arteries, there's no pulse. If you hooked her up to an EKG, she'd be flatline.
The pumps spin her blood and move it through her body.
By every metric we have to analyze patients, she's not living. But here you can see she's a vigorous, happy, playful calf, licking my hand.
In March, after practicing on 38 calves, Cohn and Frazier felt confident enough to try their device on a patient. They chose Craig Lewis, a 55-year-old who is dying from amyloidosis. The disease causes a buildup of abnormal proteins. The proteins clog the organs so much that they stop working. In Lewis's case, his heart became so damaged, doctors said he had only 12 hours left to live. His wife, Linda, said they should try it.
He wanted to live, and we didn't want to lose him. So, you know, you never know how much time you have, but it was worth it.
Lewis worked for the city of Houston. He helped maintain the city's vast system of wastewater pumps. In his garage at home, he dabbled in woodworking, metalsmithing, and what Linda calls general piddling around.
He would go into his shop and create or fix or modify something to make it work.
That's what his 2 doctors did, too. Linda says her husband appreciated how the doctors cobbled together the pulseless heart from various materials. Again, Dr. Cohn.
Dacron on the inside and fiberglass impregnated in silicone on the outside. Here's a little titanium piece that we machined that goes on here.
Cohn and Frazier didn't start totally from scratch. What they did was hook together 2 medical implants known as ventricular assist devices. A ventricular assist device has a screw-like rotor of blades. The spinning screw pushes the blood forward in a continuous flow. Thousands of people have one of these implanted near their hearts, including former Vice President Dick Cheney. But by using 2, the doctors replaced both the right and left ventricles, the entire heart.
They said, "You want to hear it?" And they put their, and I listened, and it was a hum, you know, which is amazing. He didn't have a pulse.
The doctors say the continuous flow pump should last longer than other artificial hearts and cause fewer problems. That's because each side has just 1 moving part, the constantly whirling rotor. But Cohn says they'll still have to convince the world that you don't need a pulse to live.
We look at all the animals, I mean, insects, fish, reptiles, and certainly all mammals, and see a pulsatile circulation. And so all the early research and all the early efforts were directed at making pulsatile pumps.
But when you think about it, there's only 1 reason why blood must be pumped rhythmically as opposed to continuously. It's for the heart tissue itself.
The pulsatility of the flow is essential for the heart because it can only get nourishment in between heartbeats. If you remove that from the system, none of the other organs seem to care much.
After the implant, Craig Lewis woke up and recovered somewhat. He could speak and sit up in a chair. But then he began to fade as the disease attacked his liver and kidneys.
Amyloidosis is horrible. I could see the other organs were not cooperating.
Lewis lived for more than a month with the pulseless heart. When he died in April, it was because of the underlying disease. His doctors say the pumps themselves worked flawlessly.
We knew if it wasn't a success for Craig, if they could get data that would help them, if it helps the next person, then you did good.
Biomedical companies around the world are still trying to perfect a pulsing artificial heart. But Cohn says they're like the last buggy whip manufacturers. They're fine-tuning a product that will soon become obsolete. But he's sympathetic, too. The history of invention is full of such dead ends.
When man first tried to come up with machines that flew, he looked around and saw bats and birds and butterflies and mosquitoes. Everything had wings that flapped.
But what works for Mother Nature often isn't the only mechanical solution or even the best one.
When they saw that you could create wind and that wind over a fixed wing was a great way to provide lift, then the whole field shifted. I mean, there are very few flying machines in modern times that have flapping wings. And I think this is the same intellectual leap in pumping blood or pumping fluids.
It will take a lot more to bring a continuous flow artificial heart to the market. The doctors will have to decide on a final design, find a manufacturer, and get FDA approval. Even though there's more work to be done, Dr. Bud Fraser says he's confident the pulseless approach will win out in the end.
These pumps don't wear out. We haven't pumped one to failure to date.
The trade-off, of course, is the loss of the primordial ba-bum, ba-bum of the human heart. But for these surgeons, that's a small poetic price to pay to make medical history. For NPR News, I'm Carrie Feibel in Houston.
Scientists say there is another promising way of treating heart disease that would preserve that familiar heartbeat. This approach involves using stem cells, cells that can, in theory, be coaxed into replacing heart cells damaged or destroyed by disease. Joe Palca has a status report on the field known as regenerative medicine.
Regenerating functioning heart cells has been a goal of medicine for more than a century. University of Washington scientists Michael LaFlamme and Charles Murray put it this way. To achieve that goal, they write, the heart has been stabbed, snipped, contused, cauterized, coagulated, frozen, injected with toxins, infected, and infarcted in species ranging from marine invertebrates to horses. You don't often get that kind of lovely writing in the journal Nature. So has any of that stuff worked? Well, kinda. In mice, it's possible to find stem cells that will turn into functioning, beating heart cells. And those cells do go where they're needed, replacing cells that have been damaged. But the repairs are mostly modest, and as you may know, mice aren't humans. Their hearts are much smaller, and they beat much faster. What works in mice could flop in people. There are creatures that can regenerate heart tissue without any help from smarty-pants human scientists. The zebrafish is one example. You can cut out 20% of a zebrafish's heart, and the heart will grow back to normal. Obviously, human hearts can't do that. But scientists now do believe that there are stem cells that regenerate human hearts. They just do it at a glacial pace, not nearly fast enough to make repairs in the event of injury. Scientists are trying to identify these cardiac stem cells and then figure out how to juice them up so they can repair damage caused by a heart attack. Scientists are also trying to use a cocktail of chemicals to trick other kinds of stem cells that don't normally make heart cells to take on that role. But like mechanical pumps and artificial hearts, stem cell therapy is a high-tech, high-expense solution for dealing with heart diseases. Rather than wait for the day when medicine can replace or repair your damaged ticker, the painful truth is that today, heart health is largely in your hands. Eat sensibly, quit smoking, get some exercise, all that boring stuff. Not nearly as newsworthy as the latest medical breakthrough, but probably more relevant to your health. Joe Palca, NPR News.
And finally, Weekend Edition's Jackie Leiden talks with freewheeling poet James Nave, who suddenly got serious about his craft when he found out he had prostate cancer.
I met James Nave for the first time 25 years ago while working on a story for NPR. He was a whirlwind of energy, performing poems out loud in grade schools in his hometown of Asheville, North Carolina. He went on to perform poetry all over the world, from La Paz to Paris to the Philippines. For Nave, it was all about poetry and travel and freedom and creativity. He co-founded workshops like the Imaginative Storm Writing Salon. And then, wham, he made an all-too-common midlife discovery. He had health issues, prostate cancer, the big memento mori. He confronted the disease the best way he knew how, with words, vowing to write a poem a day for the 100 days following surgery. James Nave joins us now from our bureau in New York. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jackie. Good to be here.
You know, I really love reading your poems on your website and on Facebook, and it was like peeking into a diary of your recovery, but I kept thinking to myself, why is he doing this, setting himself up this chore from the get-go?
What happened was April 1st rolled around, which was the first day after surgery, and it was also Poetry Month. And poets around the country write 30 poems in 30 days, so I thought, well, what else do I have to do? I'm here in the hospital room, nowhere to go, so why not write a poem? So I wrote the first one, the second one, the third one, and then after I arrived at 15, I thought, why not go to 100? And I was starting to see themes emerge even in the first 15 poems. So I thought, I have to track this all the way through to 100.
I wouldn't say your recovery looked fun, but it did look interesting.
Well, it was, on some level, it was fun in the sense that things were changing all the time and my identity was changing. And I woke up from the surgery in this space that I'd never been in before. So I told somebody it was like going on a really nice vacation and all I had to do was climb Everest.
Can we hear the poem, Sunday, April 7th, I Had to Look? You were recovering at some friend's home in the Carolinas.
This morning by the Carolina mountainside, I climbed down my spine, one bone at a time, into unfamiliar territory. I saw veins, arteries, cells, blood, connective tissue, nerves, heart, lungs, liver, kidneys, and bladder. As I descended, I realized I was in a rainforest filled with things I didn't expect to see. Iguanas, bats, lizards, snakes, scaly-tailed squirrels, fairy bluebirds and butterflies, beautiful, graceful, complicated butterflies. I'd never imagined millions of butterflies were free inside my body. A purple one landed on a bush, then another, red with pink dots, then another, big brown eyes. I arrived at my pelvis, stood between my hips. I thought, I'd been attacked by blades and fingers. As I surveyed the cavernous territory, I saw repair. Nothing to weep about here, I thought. With that, I climbed my spine, one bone at a time. This afternoon, my surgeon called. He said my margins were clear. The cancer had not spread.
Can you talk to us a little about your prostate cancer and what effect it's had on you and why you're eager to talk about it?
I'm not sure exactly when I first realized, maybe it was 2 or 3 days after the surgery, that this was a permanent change and that I was going to have to do something to adjust to it, and I was going to have to be very active in that. So I think that's one of the things that propelled me with these poems.
What about the question of virility? I mean, that's something that is really important to human beings of both sexes.
Well, it's true, and I've been as vital a male as anybody could be. Even so, having this change, which basically, when you have your prostate removed, it alters the way you think sexually. It's certainly a little more refined, and it's more creative, and I'm responding to women in more open ways than I responded in the past, and it's much more creative.
When's your 100th poem due?
I think my 100th poem is coming up on July the 9th.
Well, we wish you all good luck with that.
Thank you so much, Jackie. It's been a real pleasure to be here and talk about this a bit.
And to be with you, and you have a good prognosis, right?
I do. It's great, actually. I have to be very careful with my health and pay attention, but the cancer's gone and everything looks like it's going to be fine.
Well, thanks again for spending the time. My friend, the poet James Nave. For more of Nave's poems, go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/NPR Weekend.
And that's all for Your Health this week. If you just can't get enough, check out our latest health stories on NPR.org. A big shout out to Giselle Grayson for putting this podcast together this week. I'm Scott Hensley.
And I'm April Fulton. Thanks for listening.
You would not believe your eyes if 10 million fires.